I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Recent events in Kansas City have raised a new public furor about abuse by Catholic priests, but no one really knows how long the problem itself has been going on. According to the Survivors Network for those abused by priests, nearly 16,000 abuse victims have spoken out since 1950. That's around the country. Some courts, like in California, are deliberating over how far back claims of abuse can be made. But for the victims, the emotional aftermath of being abused by a priest can have no expiration date. For insight into the healing process, Susan spoke with Lawrence Neeters, a psychologist who works with priest abuse victims.
Predators have an instinct in terms of just knowing who's available, who can be reached. They look for vulnerable children, children from broken families, or from troubled families, the quote-unquote lost child kind of a role that children get into. An absent father, he could be away with business, but he could also be away in military. So a predator will come in and then fill in an empty spot in the boy's life and sometimes in the family's life. Many times predators will insinuate themselves into the structure of the family such that he's a welcome guest and they feel privileged to have him come for supper and to take their son on camping trips and be involved far more than he would be with other families and other children. So oftentimes there's a sense of privilege that is used and misused in cases like this.
And a lot has been talked about how predators groom potential victims. What does that grooming process look like?
Well, you know, you say grooming, you can also say seduction. And seduction is a process. And it just is, it's over time. It's not rushed. It's a little at a time, a little bit closer and a little bit closer. In psychology, we talk a lot about boundaries. Personal space, what belongs to you and where do you belong? And predators know how to just very quietly and patiently erode these boundaries so that, you know, if this wasn't such a big deal, well this can't be either. And little by little, and it could be 6 months, it could be a year, producing the kind of connection, the kind of attachment between the child and himself. And eventually it goes into something that's very dark. That if he tried that the first time, the kid would scream, the kid would run out, the kid would yell, the kid would be shocked. The point that a predator finally makes a serious move, the child has been seduced into accepting this, that, the next, and this isn't any different from the last time. And then it's like the monster finally swallows the prey.
So from a parent's point of view, what kind of signs or signals would they see from their child that this was happening to, particularly given your comment about how often this predator wins the trust of families?
You watch for changes, rather radical changes in the child's mood, behavior, school performance, an outgoing child that rather suddenly becomes more isolative, a compliant, friendly child that becomes more angry or frightened, a child who's done very well in school and then all of a sudden is doing very poorly, a child that, you know, with the trusted quote-unquote friend who says, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to go. Don't make me go. These would be things to follow up. Let's talk about what's going on here. What's the matter?
What do you find is unique and different about the cases that you see where a priest is involved versus other predators at large?
Well, for one thing, priests have a very esteemed place in the Catholic community, for instance. These are vicars of Christ. These are Christ stand-ins. In the era past, the men that I'm seeing come from backgrounds like my own, where priests would never be questioned or challenged, and it would be a privilege indeed to have a priest show special interest to the family. So, first of all, there's a high prestige value and a lot of respect and reverence to the priest. What's unique is also what the priest stands for, and that he is the stand-in for a godly figure. And when a priest oversteps his bounds and steps into the predator role, it's so absolutely confusing for the child, and especially if parents aren't getting it, and they keep encouraging the child to be in the company of the predator. Very, very confusing for the child. Sometimes parents actually get angry with the child for balking because it's keeping the family from having the prestige of the priest coming to visit.
One effect that this seems to have is it really shakes people's beliefs about their religion, their faith to the core. What kind of impacts have you seen with that effect?
Well, a lot of people derive a lot of strength in their life from a healthy faith. And when that faith is shaken, that source of strength is removed. And in addition to that, we're looking at children again. Children are trying to figure out what happened and why. And if the conclusion is God hates me, or God is punishing me, or somehow I deserve this, that's a felt belief. It's not a rational belief, but it's an emotionally based belief that can last a lifetime if it's not dealt with and challenged and replaced with one that's more accurate. So if God hates me, then we're taking a look at where does somebody go from there? What we've got then is the makings of despair. And we've seen here in our community reports of suicides that have occurred. And that's I think we can trace some of the suicide to that sense of despair where not even God wants me, or not even God is watching out for me.
Now, when this happens to boys, often it can happen at a time when the sexual identity is still forming. What impacts have you seen on the sexual identity of boys that this happens to early on while they're still forming their identity in this area?
It varies, and it varies with the child. Some boys will kind of gather the inner strength that they need and connect with adequate males and with peers and will develop a healthy sense of sexual identity, male sexual identity. Others are devastated and have deep-seated questions in terms of what does this mean about me? What am I, fish or fowl, so to speak? Again, that can last a lifetime. In response to that, especially in our culture tends to be non-accepting of a gay lifestyle. And especially that would be the case in the really traditional religious families. And again, that can lead to despair, which somebody tries to medicate by virtue of drugs, alcohol, sexual acting out, all sorts of different addictive behaviors in order to quell some of the distress that's inside in terms of who am I after all.
Well, yeah, I can imagine if I'm a boy that this happens to, there's a part of me that's thinking, well, because this happened, that must mean I'm homosexual, and so therefore I am.
Yes, and a predator knows how to feed on that, saying, well, see, you wanted this, you enjoyed this. I couldn't help myself. You're the reason that this happened.
Another complicating factor, I would imagine, and you were talking about sometimes this happens to fatherless boys or boys where there might be some chaos in the family. And if that's the case, what about instances where a victim may, on the one hand, abhor and be frightened by that kind of contact? On the other hand, be, I wouldn't say welcoming of it, but enjoy some aspects of it because it's attention, it's a special relationship.
Makes a lot of conflict, and the child typically concludes, there's something wrong with me. I'm bad. I'm wrong. I'm causing this to happen. It's my fault. And again, a perpetrator, knowing the psyche of a child, is going to endorse that and will strengthen that belief. And of course, if the child believes that he's bad, well, he's sure not going to display that any. So then the perpetrator can come around and be a buddy. And there's the acceptance. And yes, you really are a good boy, and I understand. We just won't talk about this.
And that's part of the difficulty, too, isn't it, that a child then is in this realm of secrecy and all of the problems that can cause.
Secrecy is simply a trap. It's a trap that swallows the child, and the child has nowhere to go. There's no one to tell, and which means not only to tell his story, but then to get some feedback, to get some information that might conflict with what he's been told. So it's a very, very dark place that a child winds up. And again, because part of that is the threat of, if I do tell, there are these dire consequences that will happen, and I'll just have to keep this to myself.
Now, of course, many of these boys grew up to be men who never have told. What kinds of issues do you find people that never tell, and finally, when they become adults, begin to deal with these issues? What kinds of symptoms do they have as adults?
A lot of this can be blocked out, pushed to the back, put on the other side of the wall, so to speak, and put their lives together and continue on. But then when one of their children comes of age, at the age at which certain things have happened, all of a sudden that wall starts to crumble, and the adult begins to become aware of what's been pushed back for so long.
How do you help people heal from this kind of trauma?
I think that the main thing is to be a good listener, and to be a listener who's listening for what it was like for them, not facts. I'm not a fact-gathering, forensic, police type of person. It's more, what was it like for you, and what did you go through? And what effect did that have on you then, and is it having on you now? And how is that interfering with you living a constructive, peaceful sort of life? How is it playing out in relationships? This is a big one. You mentioned trust. Trust is paramount in order to have a healthy, intimate relationship with somebody, that mutual trust, that letting your guard down and letting yourself be real with somebody. This is mission impossible for a lot of folks, because, and maybe not even on a conscious level, it just doesn't feel right. I just don't go there, or I can't go there. A spouse can be calling for more emotional closeness, physical closeness, and many times the survivor just can't go there.
Lawrence Neeters is an Overland Park psychologist who has worked with people who are abused by priests.
Coming up, an expert on the ancient Maya sets the record straight on 2012. You're listening to Casey Currents.